Welcome to Stopgap Talks, your go-to podcast for expert insights into the marketing, digital, creative, and research recruitment landscape. With over 30 years of experience, our consultants are here to share the wisdom, strategies, and success stories that can transform your hiring or career journey. If you enjoy the episode, don't forget to subscribe, share, and leave a review to help others find us. Now let's dive in to the latest episode of Stopgap Talks.
Hello and welcome to Stopgap Talks. We are very happy to have you here today. My name is Amanda McCarthy. I am part of the Stopgap team. And today I'm joined by performance and wellbeing expert James Pickles to explore mental health, identity and community. We know that there's a number of people out in the world trying to find a new role. And we thought we'd tie this in with Mental Health Awareness Week because the theme this year is community. So in the spirit of that, this week aims to tackle stigma and provide people with information and tools to understand and prioritize their own mental health. I know for myself, I have definitely benefited from communities throughout my life, especially in times where I was struggling. And I really encourage people to consider joining a community in person, online, just to help you feel more connected with the world out there. Let's jump right in to you, James. It is so lovely to have you here today. I thought, a good start could be if you could tell us, those unfamiliar with your work, can you start by sharing a little bit about your own journey and kind of what's brought you here?
Sure. So I'm now an executive coach and I do talks and workshops that are interactive to help high performers, people trying to do the best job that they can, to help high performers stay that way sustainably. I was once a high performer, but the method of working, my attitude, my perspective, my relationship with my job in the end wasn't sustainable. So I try and share some hard-won lessons with people from that experience so that they don't have to tread the same path that I trod.
Yeah, I can imagine it kind of leads to some sort of burnout over time. There's that high performance need to keep chasing something. What do you think were, for yourself, the early warning signs that you maybe didn't see at the time?
Well, let me go back a step, actually, Amanda. So this is, I'm properly middle-aged now. So I've been running around the workplace for 30 plus years. My first career was in hospitality. I spent the first 10, 11 years of my working life working in bars and restaurants and pubs all over the country. And I think I had a wonderful time, but I think perhaps that was an origin point of one of my paradox, successful, unsuccessful working habits since. In that industry, working 60, 70, 80, even 90 hours a week is normal. You kind of live the job. It's a lifestyle. It's not really a profession. But so I did that for about a decade. Then I moved into a sales function within the market research industry, spent 7 or 8 years at a company called Mintel in a client-facing role. Then I moved to another company called Taluna, who are an internet research facilitator. And the team that I founded and ran was exclusively designed to deal with brands, big brands, Coke, Hilton, Sony, Reckitt Benckiser, Unilever, Procter & Gamble, all of those guys. And without sounding conceited, I was very good at it. We were very successful up until 2019, so pre-COVID. And after 2 or 3 years of record-breaking growth, so we were smashing, not just beating targets, smashing targets year on year. The team that I ran was and had been for a while the fastest growing, most profitable, most successful team in Europe. Mm-hmm. And at the absolute apex of commercial and professional success, fiscally speaking, somebody asked me how I was one day. Oh. And I was so exhausted, I forgot to lie.
Oh.
My standard response would always be, great, fantastic, very bombastic. And this colleague of mine must have seen something, intuitively seen something that didn't chime with the answer I was trying to give her. And she didn't take my first answer, fine, great. She said, where's the effect of how are you really? Yeah. And then just shut up. and let me fill that space. And I was so exhausted, I accidentally told the truth, which was, can't do this anymore. This is too hard. What actually happened was, I didn't finish the sentence. I just burst into tears in front of her. And that turned into sobbing. And it happened to be in a Wetherspoons in central London. Next to her was my boss. Next to him was the head of Europe. Opposite them was the most senior sales guy that worked for me. Next to us was the entire UK sales team. And around us were all of the clients that we had all just been engaging with at the biggest trade show of the year. So I was now broken down, sobbing in front of all of my colleagues and a good chunk of our client base. And I can't stop.
That is a very terrifying position to be in. It's vulnerable, as in that bit of feeling exposed can kind of be a story that I know a lot of people can resonate for from. There's, I guess, you know, in doing that, in having this thing happen, you know, even the word vulnerability comes in there. Is there something that it taught you about your strength, being able to get to that point and maybe, you know, learn from it and become stronger in some way?
Oh, I've learned a lot. I mean, a lot changed since then. What happened after that was, actually, I was having a panic attack. I didn't know what panic attacks were, even though, weirdly, I'd had one before. But I'm so ignorant and unwilling to engage with that that I refused to understand what was really going on. I just tried to brush it under the carpet. Had this big panic attack in front of everybody. And my principal emotions at the time were fear and shame. Fear because I can't stop crying in front of everyone. And I'm really, really embarrassed. And what must they all think? Because what was happening was, I was showing them how I really felt. And I'd never learned how to do that at work.
I was going to say, it's a form of masking. Yeah, exactly. You pretend everything's okay. As kids, you kind of just are who you are. But as an adult, no one sort of teaches you how to be okay to safely share your experiences if you are in pain in any way. So,
Or even don't have some answers to some things, or not feeling very confident that day, or whatever it is. And the older we get, the more senior we become. The more pressurized, I suspect, that we feel to have all of the answers immediately and to be perfect and all the rest. But to your question about strength, I really feel differently about strength at work now. And I previously have associated with opening up, expressing how I genuinely felt about whatever the challenges were that day, that asking for help or support must have been then, that's what I thought then, a weakness. I'd be admitting to weakness as a senior. There's like gender stereotypes here, if you'll forgive me, but like a senior adult male in a senior leadership position, to not have the answers and to need or want support or help must be an expression of weakness, which is the opposite of strength. Therefore, the strong thing to do would be to not do that.
Yeah.
And I've come all the way out the other side now, and I firmly believe now that to ask for help or support must require strength and courage, because it's so bloody hard.
Exactly.
If it didn't require strength, it'd be easy and everyone would be doing it.
Exactly. Everyone would be talking about it, everyone would be comfortable with it, but in some ways, almost like the more people talk about it and more stories like this that come out, the easier it is for people to feel like they are not alone in that feeling. They find the courage through these other stories that they can connect to say, I felt like that before. Maybe I need to take that step forward and ask someone, or maybe read up on something online, or maybe get a tip or a coach or someone to just help me through some of this. So I think it's a good idea.
Yeah, I totally agree. If you think of any inspiring story of anybody that's done anything amazing, even people that, I'm making this up as I go along, even people that row solo across the ocean or scale mountains by themselves or do extreme endurance events or whatever, they might do the actual thing by themselves, but don't tell me that the build up and support didn't require a whole host of people.
Yeah.
And that they had to invite people in to assist them, train them, coach them, support them. Nothing courageous happens in isolation.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's that bit around, you know, relating to things and the people around you. And I think people are there to help build you up, which is kind of that bit on community and sharing experiences are probably going to help going forward. I guess, you know, why do you think your story resonates particularly with high achievers and those in those high performance industries, you know, like recruitment or advertising or kind of anything creative right now? What do you think's going on? How does it kind of feel like the right time to be talking about this?
It's always the right time, right? But, you know, sometimes the right than others, I guess. So in the work that I do, I'll go into organizations and I'll always tell elements of the story that I've just shared with you because I look like them. I sound like them. They look like me. They sound like me. And I don't mean like this, but when you're talking about the expectations of your team, your employees, your colleagues, the business, your family, your friends, everybody's just trying to do their best, right? And unlike many other speakers on the public speaking circuit, I'm not an Olympian. I haven't climbed Everest. I haven't done all sorts of things. I'm by most measures, completely ordinary. And the trigger point for me to collapse and burn out and become so ill as I did, I was off for 9 months unable to function. I became so ill, I lost a power of speech temporarily. It's my sheer ordinariness, I think. And the absence of big traumatic trigger event that people look at me and go, crap, if it can happen to him, it can happen to me. And when you describe perfectly ordinary, as it turns out, physiological responses to existing in periods of extreme stress, whatever the cause, we're all human. We all bleed the same. We all put our trousers on one leg at a time, all of those other funny little quotes. And people are trying to do their best, and it's very difficult to do your best all the time by yourself. So, and I think people just connect to that.
Yeah, I think it's something that I see, you know, in a lot of the people that I'm obviously supporting, the daily job seekers who I talk to. You know, a lot of them are masking how much they're struggling, you know, whether it's, you know, from their drive to succeed or how they imagine they want to be perceived by the people around them. You know, we all sort of set these goals for ourselves, but sometimes we forget that it's maybe good to check in with ourselves to make sure that our goal is still relevant to what it is that we were chasing in the first place. And I think there's a big shift in the way people are kind of pursuing their mental health going forward.
I would agree. And I don't want to deviate us onto a big, long, ranty chat about perils and evils of social media. But
yeah.
there's a lovely expression that I learned from somewhere, I forget where, about the dangers of comparing your real life to someone else's showreel.
Yeah,
I thought it was a beautiful expression that encapsulates how hard it is to observe the reality of what everyone is doing and seeing and achieving. We only see it through a carefully curated lens of social media, which isn't accurate.
It's not healthy
in any way, shape or form. Plus, we've got this pseudo connectivity via apps and chats and Slack and this and that, communicating with emojis and all the rest of it, which fools us into thinking that we've got connection and community. But it's incredibly shallow. There's no depth to it. And we're just taking as fact what we observe and then comparing ourselves, usually poorly, against this imagined reality that we're so immersed in.
So it's a very different time for a lot of people in the world right now. I guess, you know, if I'm thinking of kind of those silent struggles that people are getting along with, almost like in that comparison, you know, what are the kind of the less visible mental health impacts of, you know, things like potentially going out there competing against a lot of people when you're trying to get a job, because, you know, there's this impact of a pressure after redundancy, people are being ghosted, it's taking them a long time to find jobs, it feels more prolonged than ever. You know, what is it that people need to, you know, think about in terms of their mental health and how these things are going to impact them?
It's a good question. I've experienced redundancy. I'd worked at this other place for a decade. I was off for 9 months. I did a phased return to go back in a slightly different job to the same employer. That didn't work out very well. Then COVID was invented and lockdowns and all the rest of it and business contraction. And I was made redundant. I know that there's a technicality on language there that people should understand. Oh, no, no, it's not you that's being made redundant. Mm. It's your role that's being made redundant. Oh, yeah, so it's not personal. It bloody is.
It feels personal.
It feels extremely personal. Yeah. Somebody coming at you with a pedantic correction and language doesn't help. It's just irritating. Anyway, I could be cross. Let's choose not to. All sorts of impacts, right? So what I've noticed two things materially that I'm properly pleased with, as in grateful for the learning. One is when I was at my lowest, most ill, feeling isolated, lonely and ashamed, I felt isolated. I wasn't, actually. I was lonely in a crowd. And the point at which I decided, and it was a choice that I made, to speak more openly, more often to more people, was the point where I suddenly found out people I've known for a really long time really did understand, because they'd been there or were there, but no one was talking about it, so none of us knew. And the redundancy experience was almost identical. I was like, I'm sick of this stigma. It's bullshit. We're all going through normal human stuff. And the older you get, the more likely you are to feel redundancy or stress or pressure. It's almost an inevitability. Yeah. So in all likelihood, I am surrounded by people who've been there or will be there or are there right now. And redundancy was no exception. So the moment I was like, I'm just going to fess up. Yeah. Here's what's happened.
I think how I feel about it is important.
Quite shit. And a load of people around me went, oh, mate, I've been there. And now suddenly I'm having a chat with people that got it, who are right there next to me.
I think sometimes that's all you need, is someone to go, yeah, that's horrible. And, you know, I've been there. It's, you know, you just need someone to kind of listen and accept your truth in that moment. So, it's kind of that little bit of validation is sometimes a really important bit that we don't realize we kind of need at the time.
That's right.
And I mean, you know, how does uncertainty, especially during a job transition, like how does that affect people's sense of identity and self-worth, or how do you feel it does?
Well, I can speak for how I felt it.
Yeah.
And having spent the best part of 20 years, so 2/3 of my working life, investing very, very heavily in my work identity and seeking and receiving validation for my position in the company, the job role, the job that I did, all the rest of it. Whenever you go to a party, go, hi, I'm James. Oh, hello, John, whatever. and somebody goes, oh, hi, James, what do you do? And the stock answer is, I am a sales director. I am a this. I am a that. So is it any wonder that our identities become inextricably linked with the role that we hold?
The difficulty is,
I am not a sales director. Sales directing is what I did. Mm-hmm. It's not what I was.
Yeah.
And I got a bit lost on that. So I answer that question very differently now. Hello, what do you do? What I do is... Mm-hmm. coaching and talks and motivational experiences to help people make better choices, all the rest of it. Who I am is James, 51-year-old dude who's got two teenage kids, who likes allotments and paddle tennis. That's who I am. But what I do is something different. But if you're not clear on that, and your job is forcibly removed from you, not at the time of your choosing, is it any wonder that this, your sense of identity temporarily goes with it?
And I think there's something that you can take away from that going forward. If you had that moment where you had to kind of realize when you didn't have a job, you couldn't explain what you were doing. You know, it's almost going like, oh, yeah, I really need to reframe that as in, it's more about me as the person. That bit is a really important bit to bring forward into every conversation that you have. Like, what do you like? What are your interests? You know, do you support a team? Those kinds of things are probably more connecting to people in the day to day. So,
I was having a chat. I love that, Amanda, because I was having a chat with these sorts of topics, as I love doing these days, really openly, not exclusively, but particularly with men of a certain age, because it is so vanishingly rare that men will talk about this stuff in the way that I now quite like talking about it. Anyway, my point is, I was talking to some senior guys about recruiting, funnily enough, in the context of my kids are doing their exams and it's really stressful and they're worrying that their choices that they're taking now are going to define their whole of the rest of their lives. Like, they're not. Don't worry. And my friend says his favorite way to read CVs is from the bottom up.
Yeah.
The last thing is interesting, the last, almost as a hygiene factor, is what degree you've got. He reads that bit last, not first. So bottom up, the thing he cares most about is who you are, what you do, what brings you joy,
what you identify with,
how you spend your time outside of work voluntarily, where you've traveled. He cares about the richness of the person. The thing he cares about secondary to that is what was the last job that you did.
Yeah.
Secondary to that, what university did you go to? Or tertiary to that.
What a lovely way to look at a CV. Wouldn't I encourage it more? Being like, think about the person. There's a human behind this whole story. So, I mean, that kind of probably leads into where I was going to go next, which is, you know, what one thing would you change the way recruitment's done to improve well-being in general? But I think you kind of almost said that to me, which is that, like, as in, think about it as a person, like, as in, there is someone here who's not just a number, someone who's applying for a job, but is more than the skills that they bring, or that, you know, the points, the bullet points on their CV, to what they can bring to a job, as in, they come with a lot of a bigger experience to bring on board.
Like the more important stuff, yes, experience and competencies and all the rest of it, and knowing how PowerPoint works or whatever it is. Of course, that's all important, but it doesn't really tell you what they're like to be with.
Yeah.
It doesn't tell you what their values are. It doesn't tell you what lights them up. And actually, when you're hiring somebody, you need the competencies. You need them to do the job and, you know, want to work hard and be driven and all the rest of it. But also, you want to like them and you want them to like you. You want them to fit in.
Yeah. And you want them to bring their true selves into their job, right? I think, you know, something that's happening to me is that I speak to a number of people who are almost like myself, who have received their neurodiversity diagnosis later in life, you know, which has caused them to have a massive shift in their mental health, because it comes with this bit of, you know, either feeling isolated or other, you know, or maybe even triggering some of their conditions where, you know, they're rejection sensitive to dysphoria has come up. They know they're sensitive to it. You know, they now are changing and realigning the expectations of what the future holds. They're becoming those advocates internally in their workplaces, and, you know, they're prioritizing their well-being more than ever. But I think it's almost like you're saying that the stigma is kind of lifting slowly in these places. That's why we're seeing it in the headlines, that we're kind of seeing people disclose it on their CVs. Where, you know, I think there is a shift going on in some places. But yeah, there's definitely something that's changing in job applications, in people coming forward. You know, if a company is, you know, has a feeling that they may not fit in there, they, you know, they might look at people on that website and go, there's no one that looks like me. There's no one that feels like me. I don't know if I want to go and apply for that job. So I think now more than ever, people are really focusing on that fit, because it takes them such a long time to find a job. So it's knowing that wherever you're going to land is going to accept you for exactly who you are. So yeah, an interesting time.
I agree. In our household, we've also recently had diagnoses of neurodiversity. So we're also right now, live example, getting to understand the contexts and frameworks that are helpful and more productive versus those that aren't.
Yeah.
And I'd love it if we arrived in a place where we saw it just like that.
Yeah.
So I have characteristics, mm-hmm. and there are environments in which I'm more likely to flourish than others.
Yeah.
And I'm not really going to know what those environments are unless I've got the courage to ask specific questions about those environments.
Mm-hmm.
And worse, my worst case scenario now is I don't ask out of fear, and I don't tell the truth out of fear. And what would be worse than getting a job in a place where I wouldn't be seen or heard or understood or valued for who I actually am? I've talked myself into a job in the wrong environment.
Yeah.
That is disaster level outcome for me.
Yeah. Convince yourself that it's what you were pursuing.
I've got bills to pay and mortgages and pressure, and it's like, okay, even if I have a job in a horrible place, it's better than losing my house.
Yeah.
So, okay, but maybe consider that job not as the job, but a job.
Gonna
get you to.
Yeah. I think, and I mean, you know, in the vein of that, like, you know, what do you think, in your view, is the role of that's changing now as a recruiter. What role does a recruiter play in someone's mental well-being, intentionally or not? Like, as in, if they're the first line that people are contacting, what responsibility would a recruiter hold, whether that's in-house or an agency like ourselves?
You have a responsibility to treat someone as you would be treated.
Yeah.
To recognize that the person on the other end of the phone or an email is a human being, probably at quite a low ebb. No disrespect to the recruitment business, but I imagine most people come to recruiters because they need a job. Like, if they could have got a better job somewhere else without a recruiter, that's what they would have chosen.
Yeah.
So they're probably feeling a bit vulnerable and a bit exposed. So remembering front and center, this is a human being here who is going to be sensitive to how they are treated.
And I mean, how do you think that like recruiters can support those candidates with empathy without crossing into the territory of not being a qualified, therapist in some way? Like, as in, how can they support people safely in those first interactions, especially, I guess, if people are in some sort of pain or vulnerability?
This is a question I regularly have to wrestle with myself. Not wrestle, actually, acknowledge. Okay. I have to acknowledge this question a lot. I'm a trained coach. I'm not a trained therapist.
Yeah.
I've done mental health first aid training. That doesn't mean that I'm a clinical psychologist. So I'm pretty good at getting people to open up and tell the truth. Mm-hmm. And I'm enabling them to tell the truth to themselves, actually, principally. But that sometimes can stray into upsetting territory. So I have to remember two key things at this point. Firstly, I'm not a therapist. I'm not a clinician. And in the context of that, my job is to support them, not solve their problem.
Yeah.
So the moment I draw breath to offer advice or solutions or suggestions in response to the trouble or pain or whatever it is that I'm witnessing, the moment I do that, I'm crossing the line because I'm not equipped to do that. But I can still stay on the call and support, which largely means listen, empathize, be warm, yeah. Be interested.
Yeah.
When they're going, I don't know what to do, I'm desperate. It isn't my job to step into that. It's like, okay, well, one of the things that I can do is help guide you towards where help lives.
Yeah. These are the services that I'd signpost you towards. I'd say, you know, it sounds like you're in some sort of distress. Maybe you want to speak to these people. Maybe you want to use the service. I think it's probably a starting off point. I think, even in my own role, I often feel like that therapist. I'm sure, like you've just said, people come to you, they're in a shift in their life, and it's like a balancing act, supporting them, knowing that there's something more going on, and potentially that you're uncovering something that they're not even aware of, or pointing towards something that feels like a sore point. Even for a number of us here at our team here at Stopgap, we're getting people come to us with bigger struggles than ever, you know, redundancies and being without a job for a long time, not being able to cover those bills, or as a result, dealing with those high pressured environments that are changing with more workload coming on with smaller budgets. And they're kind of needing that practical advice on what next steps they need to take. So as soon as I hear that distress, if I can hear that hitch in a voice or that emotional outlet is coming, it's that bit where I guess the first place I kind of go is, I think you need to, additionally to this job search, we're going to go through some basics, but I think that you need to also maybe look at some additional mental health support because you're going through a very difficult time. There's something else going on here.
Quite right, Amanda. I would add, actually.
No.
I suspect that you and your colleagues are quite empathetic. You've probably got quite high EQ. And we're all problem solvers. And no one wants to see anybody in pain. So, you know, you really want to get involved and help take pain away. And I this is another thing I learned the hard way. So I've been told many, many terrible stories, and I've witnessed many people breaking down and all the rest of it. And, that's the thing that's happened. It started making me ill.
You take on the burden, because I was taking it on.
And I had to go back to my therapist and explore some of this. I was like, I'm trying to do my best here and it's making me ill. So that's unsafe for me. And the framing that she described to me that I found incredibly useful, she was like, you mustn't be a vessel. You must be a conduit.
Okay. Yeah. I think
You cannot take on all of these people's stories.
Yeah.
They have to go through you, not stay in you. So what are you doing to let those stories pass through you?
Yeah.
You got to say that stuff out loud too. They've told you, you've got to tell it to let it pass through. Otherwise, we're going to.
Otherwise, you hold on to it. Yeah. And I think there's probably even managers and teams that are probably feeling something similar. You know, they're going to have people in their teams that are feeling those emotional overwhelms and that. And I guess, you know, what kind of advice do you think you would give to set some healthy emotional boundaries to people in those people-facing roles? Like, as in how as I guess, as a manager, could you support your team in a similar way?
The best thing, and this is my opinion, I'm not saying here's the answer, I'm just saying my opinion. The best thing that all and any of us can do, regardless of our hierarchical structure, whether we're managers or not, that as people, the best thing we can do might be counterintuitive, might sound selfish even. The best thing we can do is make sure that we're okay. Oxygen mask on first.
Yes.
You can't help anyone sustainably and materially if you're not okay yourself. It feels good to give and be like philanthropic and selfless and all of those things. And we kind of taught it as an attribute, as a virtue. To be selfish is to be mean, and to be selfless is to be good. I'm like, yeah, but it's not sustainable. You've got to be good yourself.
Yeah. Can't be a people pleaser all the time.
So yeah. Zero in on yourself first, and you'll be better able then to identify what your role is in that conversation, the difference between being a supporter and a solver, which line you should tread, the point at which you're not even being asked for an answer.
Yeah.
You're just there to listen.
Listen.
But you can then guide them towards somebody else. I'd say succinctly, make sure you're okay first.
I think that's a good bit of advice. I mean, leading into that as well, like, I guess I think of, you know, you've been talking about the power of community before, and you know, how can job seekers create or access that community, whether that's at work or in their personal lives, you know, when they are feeling more isolated? You know, what do you recommend?
So what I do, didn't do it before, but what I do now, I work for myself, actually. So loneliness and isolation are a real threat to me. That's punchy language, perhaps, but it is like a real material threat to my sense of self, confidence, validation, all of those things. Being by myself too much isn't good for me. Never has been. I've always been a team person. I like people. So what I have to do is add some discipline into my routine to make sure I put myself where people are. Don't be in the house all the time. Working from home and virtual and hybrid has had some benefits, undeniably. Mm-hmm. It's had some catastrophic downsides, creating extreme isolation and loneliness, disconnect, back-to-backs, overwhelm, people teleporting from one meeting to the next, perpetually underprepared and late, often hungry, thirsty, and needing a wee. They don't even know what the third meeting was about, because as they fly 5 minutes late into it, thinking, oh, I've looked at all these chats that I've had today, therefore I'm feeling part of a community. No, you're not, in my opinion. So I do fake commutes, as I did this morning. I leave my house, go for a fake commute, go for a walk through a park to a coffee shop where I am recognized. We're not mates, but they're like, morning, flat white. And I'm like, oh, yeah, hi, how are you? Bit of human connection, bit of human energy. Wander around, and by the time I get home, I've transitioned from home mode to work.
What a great bit of advice. I think that is a really simple thing to do that just kind of gets you out of your own space and changes your mindset in a very small way, but probably quite fundamental to your happiness for the rest of the day.
Plus sunny, plus sunlight, on skin, vitamin D, plus, I know, 5,000 steps or something, plus breathing in the pheromones of the trees, which has a material impact on your central nervous system immediately, demonstrably. Mm-hmm. And all of that's been done half an hour in the morning.
Yeah, good idea. I mean, yeah, I think leading into that, like, you know, what would you say to someone who doesn't feel like they fit in anywhere in any community? They don't enjoy that coffee with the individual that doesn't really know them. What would you say to someone who is probably further down that path right now? They're feeling really on their own. How do they go out there and find a place or way to connect to people?
That's the answer. In the question is the answer. Go out there and find it.
Good.
Now, it is not going to arrive to your desk in your bedroom all by itself. It sounds trite and too mm-hmm. simple, and I'm not saying that the simple step is easy to do.
No.
When we're feeling like that, with cruel irony, even the simplest, most practical things can feel like the hardest thing that you've got to do. Mm-hmm. Like, so it'll be hard, but boy, it'll be worth it. And like any, I'm basically saying step out of your comfort zone. And if you, particularly if you are a bit more introverted in character and you're not gregarious and all the rest of it, your comfort zone is to stay in the zone of where you are. My relationship to comfort zone as a concept, I used to think it was fixed and finite and you would step out of it and step back in. I now realize that stepping out of your comfort zone plus some patience allows time for your comfort zone to catch up with you. So the first time that you do the thing to go out in order to find your community, and if you haven't got one, it's probably you haven't got one yet.
There'll be something that you like, whether it's an online group or, you know, like a sports team or a game that you like. It's just engaging in a very small way, a small step towards that feeling connected to someone else.
So take that step.
Yeah.
However small, take it. Take, again, this is entirely my opinions, but to take the brave decision that I'd rather be known for who I actually am than who I'm pretending to be. So the earliest that I can get to that, the better. And I know probably 60% of the time that I've done this, I am, to my great surprise, then greeted by somebody who I have loads in common with. But we wouldn't have known that if we'd just done the usual surface level.
Yeah, I'm okay. Yeah, this is what I do.
Yeah,
I'm okay. Yeah, I get that.
Yeah, by the way, I'm not advocating heart on sleeve and that I tell absolutely everyone I've ever met how I actually am in enormous detail.
I don't know. It'd be overwhelming for anyone, I think.
That'd be
Yeah.
But now and again, you just get an instinct, you know, hey, how are you? How are you really? And if they're not replying yet, probably because you haven't given yet. You've got to give to receive, right? It's really hard to go first. Much easier to go second.
Yeah.
I think, well, I tell you what, I'm going to take a chance. I'm going to tell you some of how I'm really feeling.
Yeah.
And that opens the door for you to do the same. So back to your question about strength earlier on and courage and so on.
Yeah.
I hear it said a lot. I heard it said yesterday. I was at a thing yesterday for a team. And somebody said, yeah, but everyone's so busy and I don't want to be a burden. I don't want to bother them with my problems or the rest of it. So I'll keep it to myself, like it's a virtue to do it by yourself. I'm like, yeah, but you're shutting the door. What they might need actually is they might need you to ask for their help because they really need yours.
Yeah. It's going back and forth. It is. It's a giving and it's a receiving in order to do it. And sometimes people can feel less ashamed or less worried because they hear you are struggling or, you know, I just had a really bad thing happen to me last night. And that person could go, oh, that's happened to me before. Man, that's horrible. And that could change someone's entire outlook for a day for a big problem in their life just because someone else potentially was going through it before. Yeah, okay, so that makes, I think that's a great bit of advice. And I mean, you know, what do you think inclusive leadership looks like when it comes to mental health going forward? Where do they need to start in the basics? Where is it?
That's one question that we could have totally focused on for more than 40 minutes. I hear the word authentic a lot. Ooh, to be a good leader is to be authentic. And I suspect that authentic has become some sort of byword for openness or what have you. A bit like, unless you're super open and really sherry about your feelings, that means you can't be authentic. And if you're not authentic, you're not a good leader. I'm like, but what about the more introverted, more private leader who thinks, that's not how I work.
Yeah.
I'm not comfortable with that. I don't want to, and you're forcing me to, and that's bad for their mental health. And actually, by asking them to be authentic, we're asking them to be inauthentic.
Yeah.
So there's a paradox.
Yeah.
So I think of leadership as a collective, therefore, rather than a person. So if we take as true that people follow examples, observed examples more than they follow PowerPoints, they will do what they see, not what they're told. So within your leadership structure, and let's also assume still, despite what Trump and other people are advocating for, of the rolling back of ED&I policies, which is frankly horrifying, disgusting and ridiculous. Anyway, let's just park that for a moment. To have a diverse breadth of people within your leadership means that you have got the best that all of humans have to bear, and surely you would want that. So if you're not the person, if you're not the individual that's comfortable sharing on that level to that depth, that's fine, but it is your responsibility to make sure that there is someone there that can fulfill that role. It doesn't necessarily have to be you, but someone has to, and they have to be, without doubt, they have to have your total backing to do so. That is your responsibility of the leader. If it's not going to be you, you damn well have to find someone who can, and make it very, very obvious that they can, and that that you've got their back.
Yeah, I think, that's kind of the most important thing, is to make sure that there are people around that anyone can go to, or we're talking about role models. We're just talking about someone that someone could relate to or come to with a problem, a safe harbor, someone who they can maybe get some direction from if they're struggling with a problem. They ideally are going to try and find someone who maybe feels a bit more like them.
And if they don't find it within the organization that they're in, they're going to be leaving.
Or looking for that advice somewhere else.
in an organization that can see them for who they are and value them for what they bring. So to not do that within leadership is at best short-sighted. And at worst, you're signing the death warrant on the longevity of your business here, whether you know it or not. So do better.
Yeah. I mean, thank you so much for kind of just opening up about a lot of these different topics. I mean, you've obviously given some very important things, bits of advice to help people just starting a conversation or knowing when to kind of look at their identity and their mental health, and finding small ways to either connect with someone or to go out there and feel less afraid to maybe say how they're actually feeling. So I'm sure it's going to resonate with a number of people and help them feel a bit better in their next steps or their journey. And even then, like you said, around finding a community, you don't have to find something big. Maybe you just go out, get that cup of coffee, and just say hi to the same barista you see every day. That kind of bit will make you start to feel connected to someone else other than yourself is a great little takeaway. So James, maybe I'll kind of just go into some final thoughts here. Tell our listeners here at Stopgap Talks, where they can find out more about you, access your services, how can they connect to you?
I really like LinkedIn. I'm on it a lot. If you roll back 6 years, you'll see my banal, asinine corporate identity of me pushing out messages that marketing told me to pretend to be excited to buy. So don't roll back too far. But if you look at me now, what I say and what I post on LinkedIn is what I think and what I talk about and what I believe. So if you're interested to hear more about what I think and believe and tips, or if you want pictures of me at my allotment, which pops up, find me on LinkedIn, James Pickles. I've got a website, of course, like most people's websites, so it's a little bit out of date, but it exists there, and I've done a number of blogs, and it'll tell you a bit more about the story. So jamespicklescoaching.co.uk, and between the two, that will deliver you to opportunity to DM me or find my email address or whatever. So I just would ask then, if anybody's interested in learning about the kind of talks and workshops and coaching for individuals and teams that I do to help them help themselves to just do a good job, the best that they can, perform highly, and not do so at the cost of their own health and their relationships. I'd love to hear from you. There's no commitment. Everything just starts with a conversation, and we may find out at the end of that conversation that I'm a good fit for you. We also may find out that I'm not.
Yeah.
And that's fine too. Either way, we're going to have found out something. So
exactly. I think sometimes people need to explore it, and they, asking for help, sometimes it comes with that initial, I'm struggling with this problem. Do you think you can help me? And that alone is probably going to lift a bit of weight off of someone's mind, because it might have been their first step to actually look after themselves by coming to someone like you to help them get through it.
Well, regardless of me for a minute, because it also applies to all of the resources that are out there and wonderful people that people can access, wouldn't it be nice if that we asked for help and support before we needed it so that we didn't need it?
Yeah. Thinking about it ahead of time. All really lovely. I guess at this point as well, I'm just going to say, you know, we're obviously talking about this wider topic of mental health. You know, we're going to put some resources on here for key mental health services for the Samaritans and Shouts and Mind and a number of places that hopefully will at least have a lot of resources for you to jump right into. But if you do need some help, then I'd recommend reaching out to any of them, especially if you're struggling. And in general, I just want to say thanks again for joining me today, James. It was so lovely to get to know you and to kind of find out a bit about you. So thank you very much for that.
Can I leave you with a quote?
Go for it.
That I like, by C.S. Lewis, the author of The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. Another such book, which I loved as a child. And the quote goes like this. What? You too? I thought I was the only one. And from that, friendship was born.
I absolutely love that quote. And I think it's very important more than ever, you know, again, to look for your community, to find one that you fit into and find ways to be passionate and talk about the things that you love, even if you think you're the only one that loves it. I think it's great to have some sort of connection. So, yeah. Thank you very much to everyone. I definitely think go and take a look at some of our other podcasts and definitely subscribe if you like what we're putting out there. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Amanda. Thanks, Holly.
Bye.